Hey there, come on in. It's time for Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is we don't talk about Right Club, but for you, we're breaking the rule.
Hello, I'm Pat. Welcome to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by Steph, Nicola, Linda, and Teresa.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
This week on Write Club, we're going to hear Steph reading from her work in progress, Helling Lie, and we'll be offering her some constructive criticism. And today we're going to talk about the importance of authenticity in setting and period. And as usual, we'll be finishing off with a couple of suggestions for a book at bedtime. But first, Teresa's going to ask us to
name the novel.
Teresa.
Thank you. Okay. Pens and paper ready, everyone?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Shouting out the answer. I'm hoping this is an easy one. When he was nearly 13, my brother Jem got his arm badly broken at the elbow.
Yep.
And a famous opening
line
from which 20th century novel? So, everybody but Nicola. Okay.
I've got an awful lot of 20th century novels
for
to
Nicola
read.
And, our listeners.
Our listeners have probably got it all as well, Nicola.
Don't make me feel bad.
The second clue. This Pulitzer Prize-winning novel has become a modern American classic. Okay, not there yet. Okay, and the third and final clue. The novel was filmed in 1962 with Gregory Peck playing Atticus Finch.
No.
No.
I know we talked about this the other day and I still can't remember it. Well, where are all the great British novels we should be using in this section?
Okay, I'll bear that in mind for the future. I think most people would include this book in their list of favourites, wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, right. I better read it then.
Well done. I did say it was an easy one, but we had quite a hard one. There,
I think someone who has read an awful lot, but not the same books as you lot, where would I find a starter pack of great American novels, British novels to read?
If you go onto Amazon and you Google great American novels, I think you might find a few come up.
Yeah. So are there any great British novels? Yeah. Well, I did too. And I got an A-plus in English literature, but I remember it was largely Shakespeare.
Shakespeare, yeah. This is low-level text for me, and I think it's still
often
is a GCSE.
No, I did, I'm like Nicola, I did British text. Oh, no,
yeah,
I did Mark Twain.
I mean, I've read Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer or something like that.
But, I love those
books. Why is it the great American literature is... So, you know, we're defaulting to that. Rather, no offence, Linda, but
why are we?
You know, why is there a great British literature?
I'm defaulting. I was looking for something that I thought was sort of medium hard to easy. And I did do C.S. Lewis, who I believe is Northern Irish. Is that right, or have I made that up?
I don't know what he is.
I don't know.
But I did James Joyce. A couple of weeks ago.
Well, I've noticed a distinct bias towards the American literature, so let's redress the balance in future.
Stop whining.
Come on.
Give me a chance.
The thing is, if we did Pride and Prejudice or Jane Eyre or all of those great classic British novels, they're too easy, aren't they?
They're not modern great British novels, though, are they?
I think we should mix it up, and I have tried when I'm doing this to mix it up.
Teresa, totally not a criticism against you. As the weeks have gone past, I've just noticed that, you know, when we're talking about modern literature, we're generally talking about American modern literature.
But you did get the Dan Brown one.
Yeah,
and that's American.
Yeah, but nobody would call that literature. Even I wouldn't call it literature.
Controversial.
It depends in which sense you're using the word literature.
Well, when it's my turn to do this, I'm going to come up with some good British modern novels.
Well, there's an extra clue before we start.
I must say that my next one is a British.
Okay.
As a clue.
It's just sour grapes, really.
And following on from that, I was wondering if... And I'll say outright, I haven't. Has anyone read Go Set a Watchman?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I refuse to read.
Well,
did you?
No, I haven't read it. And in a way, I was quite sad that it was published because there seems to be something rather marvellous in having only written one novel,
right,
but it being such a stunning, influential, important novel. So that seemed rather diluted by because of the rupture.
I think...
I'm sorry, for Nicola, who I'm sure doesn't know what we're talking about.
No, no idea.
Harper Lee had only written the one novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, in her whole life. But then, posthumously, somebody got into her papers, nosies, and published
cobbled together a book.
What is it?
Go Set a Watchman,
yeah. And it was controversial because we don't know how she would have wanted it done, do we?
Yeah.
And
the story was that wasn't that written first, and then she decided
it wasn't good enough to see the light of day.
And she started again, and it's very, very different. And it kind of took the shine off Mockingbird, and that, not to give anything away, but it hurt.
Let's say sort of ploughing the same field as To Kill a Mockingbird.
The situations are essentially the same, but there are some very significant differences.
Right. Well, my feeling is I'm not going to read it because if the author did not want it out in the public yet, I'm going to respect that. And I thought, the people who are putting it out now are just trying to make money off her name, and I don't respect that. So I refuse to buy or read that book.
I think this is something we could discuss in future episodes because, you know, this whole inner critic thing and things, people, you know, subjective deciding whether works well are good or...
Right.
Yeah.
That would be an interesting conversation to have, I think.
Yeah. Right. And if I have anything left, when I'm near my death, if I have the ability, I will burn anything I have that isn't finished or that I don't want anyone to see.
Mm-hmm.
Because, obviously, I don't want them to see it, so that's why it's not out there.
Right.
Wow.
Well, are you going to leave just the message that you have? But we all have piles. Of
you can see her face.
We all have piles. That's something different.
Okay, but I'm talking about
piles of scribbles.
Things that you've begun, didn't think were good enough, or you put it back for later because there's an idea in it, but it's not something that you're necessarily proud of. And I thought, I don't want people to read those things, but I don't mean that your work is marvelous and you know.
No. That wasn't why I was pulling a face.
Oh, you really were pulling a face, British. You were making a face.
Really?
Who's chairing this episode?
Take control.
Let's move on. I think, yes, well, thank you for that. Next time, can you run it by us for sort of controversial issues?
Okay.
Yes.
You're going to read us a short excerpt from your work in progress. Would you just fill us in a little bit on the background to this?
Yes, it's about a lady called Grace, and it's set in a place called Hellinglie, which is a real place in Sussex. And back in the late 19th and early 20th century, in fact, right up until the latter half of the 20th century, it was a place where there was a very large Victorian lunatic asylum, which then became a mental hospital. I mean, the building didn't change, but the name of the place changed. And poor Grace finds herself incarcerated in this place fairly early on in the novel.
Mm. Okay. And whereabouts at what stage in the novel are you going to take this from?
She's actually been forcibly removed from her home and her children. And she's been in the hospital for about a week. For observation, she's there under an urgency order, which is a bit like a kind of temporary committal.
Yeah.
She's under an urgency order for observation, and she's now about to go into a meeting with her doctor.
Okay, whenever you're ready.
Dr. Fitzpatrick sat behind what had once been a magnificent oak desk with a green leather inlay. Now its surface was worn and scratched, pockmarked from small burns from carelessly smoked cigarettes and pipes. A heavy black telephone with a large silver dial sat next to a ceramic ashtray, both peppered with dust. The walls and ceilings had yellowed like milk gone sour. The rug poking out from beneath the desk was threadbare and faded. Only the view through the window gave any hint of the prestige attached to the room, which overlooked a sweeping drive that disappeared into the fog. It seemed strange that in his own environs Dr. Fitzpatrick should seem so diminished, so much less imposing than when Grace had last seen him filling her parlour in Conway Street. He looked as neglected as his office, his shoulders hunched as he read the top page of a pile of papers in front of him. His face looked at it as if it had been kept folded overnight and the creases had yet to drop out. Blue peeked out from behind the hat stand in the corner with her finger pressed to her lips, then bobbed back, hidden by the doctor's coat, which hung limp, like a man overcome with exhaustion. "Good morning. Please sit down." He gestured to the upright chair in the centre of the room. "Thank you." Grace sat and arranged herself, unsure whether to fold her arms or cross her legs. Best not to look too anxious, but not too cocksure either. Just behave normally, she told herself, stomach lurching with a cocktail of dread and anticipation. "I am Dr. Fitzpatrick." "Yes, doctor, I remember." "Good, good. And how are you?" "I'm fine, thank you. Absolutely fine." Grace wondered if she was too cheerful and arranged her face in a more serious visage. Turning his attention to Sister Burton, the man continued, "How's she been?" "She's settled in well, doctor. Washes, dresses, feeds herself. She's been continent since she's been on the ward. She's done some work therapy sessions in the laundry too. She can be a little belligerent, but on the whole she gets on with everyone and is beginning to mix with the other patients." "Belligerent, you say?" The doctor peered over the top of his glasses with raised eyebrows. "Perhaps opinionated is a better word." Grace cleared her throat. "I think Sister Burton is referring to my resistance to being treated like a child instead of a grown woman." "Go on." The doctor was interested. "I objected to the over-familiarity of staff, which seems to be the common practice in this place. I told Sister Burton I wished to be addressed as Mrs. Wheeler, which seemed to offend her in some way." "Ah, I see." The doctor scribbled on a piece of paper. "And why you have to call the gardens airing courts, I have no idea." Sister flicked her head upwards, held both hands out, palm up. "Quod erat demonstrandum." Blue popped out from behind the coat stand and waggled a forefinger in a caricature of a scolding schoolmistress. Grace stifled a giggle. The doctor's head snapped back. He watched Grace for a moment, then turned to the sister again. "What of her moods?" "She often cries at night and has shown extreme anxiety about her children, often asks for news of them and is seldom satisfied with our explanations." "Explanations?" Grace exploded. "They've told me nothing I didn't know the day I got here. It's been almost a week and not a damn word." Seeing the look which passed between the doctor and sister, Grace struggled to contain her anger. She looked down at her lap and scratched her palms furiously. "Of course I am anxious. I am their mother. Surely it would be rather odd if I weren't." "Grace is belligerent," said Mabel. The doctor made no comment, but made a few more notes and addressed the sister again. "What about delusions and hallucinations?" "Oh yes, we hear her talking to herself often. Most days, I'd say. She gets very animated at times, laughs for no obvious reason." The doctor looked at Grace for a few seconds longer than was comfortable. "Can't it be that I'm a naturally happy person?" Grace tried to blink away her anxiety. "When she gets distressed, she sometimes holds her hands over her ears and calls for quiet." Clearly the sister was determined to undermine any justification. Grace scowled at her. "Grace is cross. Grace is unhappy." The doctor's face was expressionless as he wrote once again on the pad in front of him. "Thank you, sister." He turned to Grace. what do you know about this hospital? It's the lunatic asylum. Everyone around here knows.
Thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Interesting.
You know, I feel so sorry for Graves here because she's making perfect sense. Of course I'm anxious about my children. Of course I want to know about them. And how appropriate she's behaving. Mm-hmm. And they're poo-pooing it because they don't, I guess, what, do they not want her to feel anything or something? It's so compelling, this piece. I really
think it's a wonderful piece. I don't feel sorry, I feel outraged.
For me, yeah.
I mean, imagine being a mother who's been responsible for, solely responsible for her children, and her husband's away at war, and then suddenly she's taken into this place where she has no power and she can't fulfil that responsibility. Right. It must be terrible.
And any attempt to sort of explain or justify herself or get mildly irritated by something, and it's immediately seen as outrageous behaviour.
It's seen as a sign of mental illness.
Mm. Right.
Her anxiety for her children.
Right.
Obedience and passivity is equated with sanity.
Right.
It's female,
absolutely.
It's getting us all riled up, isn't it?
It's true. I do feel angry for Grace, but at the same time, because of the clever way that Stephanie has introduced her hallucinations, if I can use that word, Blue and Grace,
Mabel.
You do recognise that Grace is unwell.
Yeah,
Is that fair to say, Stephanie?
It's yeah, you could interpret hearing voices and seeing people as being unwell.
Our culture does. Perhaps judgmental there as well, but there is something.
Certainly, in 1941, that was considered enough not to be allowed to mix with.
There was a couple of phrases I absolutely loved. The one where you talked about his face being folded overnight.
Yes.
I thought that just really, I could picture that. Yeah. And when you talk about her scratching her palms, that for me was the one thing that showed extreme anxiety because, you know, not many people sit and actually scratch their palms. And so that made me feel her anxiety.
Good.
So they're creating the anxiety.
Yes.
I mean, there are so many lovely descriptive bits, but the walls and ceilings are yellowed like milk gone sour.
Oh, that's what I love. That's wonderful. Milk gone sour.
Yeah, I mean, the atmosphere created by that first set of description, the detail of the desk and the ashtray and then peppered with dust and so on, just created a very, very vivid picture.
And it also creates a picture of doctors who don't actually... Who aren't really at the top of their game because if they're not looking after a beautiful old desk, then how well are they going to look after the patients? That's a worry.
It was the war.
Yeah.
The war was on. Yeah. It didn't necessarily.
Yeah. Doesn't stop you wielding a duster, my dear.
Or a man of any description. If I can pick up on a couple of little things.
Please do.
So, I don't know, things that didn't seem as smooth or jarred. So, when you see, say, only the view through the window gave any hint of the prestige attached to the room. Prestige attached seemed a bit clumsy to me, and I wondered whether you meant to say prestige that the room formerly, previously conveyed.
Mm-hmm.
So these are tiny
things.
Yes,
but I'm with you on that. That's very useful, thank you.
And the first time that Blue peeps out...
Mm-hmm.
From behind the doctor's coat, and then you start the next little bit. Please sit down. He gestured. Blue or the doctor had that little moment. I mean, I know it's the doctor, but
Blue is actually female, which is established earlier on. But no, you're right. It does some.
I just don't like visage
bit contrived. Yeah.
No, not contrived. I just didn't. I don't know. A more serious expression, a more serious face. I don't know, I didn't like it. But there you go. Overall, I absolutely love it. I think it's beautifully written. It certainly made me cry.
Thank you. Well, that's great because I'm starting on the edits and so I need tips and tricks like that.
Well, I like the ending there. You know, what do you know about the hospital? It's a lunatic asylum. Everyone knows that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was wonderful how cogent she was being at that point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And... I understand that she's ill, but she's also a person who deserves a lot more respect than they're giving her. And
Asking to be addressed as correctly as was normal in the society at that time, as Mrs. whatever, rather than using the forename, which would be treating someone like a child.
Right.
It's not a sign of illness, it's just saying, respect me, treat me with some decency.
But unfortunately, you know, people that were mentally ill were infantilised as part of the... And it wasn't considered being disrespectful, it was considered being caring,
being gentle,
looking after
and kind,
them,
and
you know, making them feel at home by using their pet name.
Right.
I think you're skirting a really wonderful line. There's a sort of, every time I hear bits from it, I feel this sort of brooding horror about what's happening to her, and the fact that, you know, we can relate to her and root for her, is it sort of overcomes that. And there's a real tension there that I find really interesting and powerful.
Good. Thank you.
Linda, I have to say, you look as if you've got something that you want to get off your chest?
Well, ever since we talked about making the face and pulling the face, I mean, I thought, how many times, what is it with you Brits? the way you put your language, I think, because you say aluminium, not aluminum, which is far more straightforward and understandable. And then you got...
comprehensible.
whose version is comprehensible? The American
aluminium. How could, can you say aluminium man? The aluminium man.
The aluminium man. Well, I can, but it's ridiculous because it's the aluminium man. Who's
well, the man who makes aluminium.
Oh, all right. But how about when you say Pat? Celebratory? How did you pronounce that?
Celebratory.
Oh, celebratory. No, celebratory. Celebratory. Garage. Garage. We say garage. Garage. And you say garage.
Garage.
Even worse. Even worse. Half the time I can't understand what we're going to be eating. You say crisp. When you mean potato chips. You say...
chips are made of potato and they're fried.
Well, yes, but they are, you know, I mean, we say potato chips.
Yes,
they're made of potatoes and they're fried.
What do you call the pieces of potato that are fried and eaten hot?
Fries.
French fries.
No, they're
French
not French fries. They're chips.
Skinny, horrible French fries.
Yeah. They're not chips, proper chips,
you know? And then you have everybody going to the theatre.
Or the loo.
Or the...
Or the loo in the theatre.
No, it's theatre.
Well, you don't even spell theatre properly. You spell it E-R.
I know. You spell it R-E. You've gotten the words mixed there. I mean, the letters mixed. And it's just ridiculous. Many of the things that you're doing here with a car, even. You got the boot, not the trunk. Why would it be a boot? A boot is something, a shoe you wear or some footwear.
No, they're galoshes. I've been secretly learning American.
Well, you might be making an effort. You're not quite there yet. But then the hood, you call it a bonnet. Mm-hmm. A bonnet you wear on your head. That, you know,
well, why would you wear on your head?
Well, but it's not the same. You know, you guys are just wrong, wrong, wrong. I don't care how much you really want to say that you invented the language first, or you had it first, and then we took it over. We took it over because you were butchering it.
Do you know what the worst thing is?
We need to fix it.
I've had to learn to speak American because there are so much many more of you in the world that we have to now. Are, you know, when you're writing a marketing language, you have to write American.
Oh, it's, really?
You're taking over.
Well,
you don't spell colour without a U.
No,
do you?
No, I haven't gone that far yet, but I do things like jewelry. I mean, another one's jewelry and jewelry.
Yes,
there's you know, there's
what
so many words. Jewelry, we would say jewelry.
It's
you jewelry. Say jewelry.
Jewelry, yeah.
Aeroplane.
Aeroplane. Aeroplane. That sounds like a child.
No, or... aeroplane is the correct word.
Yes. No, it is, dear.
Oh, I know what's coming next now.
Who invented it?
Yeah, but then, you know, you go to the loo. I don't understand loo. It's a bathroom.
It's a miracle. A it's a miracle that you survive, really, isn't it? You get from one day's end to the next without starving or getting lost.
Making yourself
up. Well, I get around perfectly well. I line up for things, too. I don't queue, stand in a queue, stand in a
And you
queue.
Go on an elevator rather than a lift.
Oh,
getting yes. that wrong can be very dangerous.
You want to give me a lift? Yeah, that's when you're hitchhiking or something, you know? Lift for an elevator. Well, anyway, you know, you really... I mean, think about it. Elevate. You're going to go up. Lift
is lifting up as well.
Yeah. Not necessarily.
Yeah, it's, this, it's a posher word. Elevate, the verb, is another word for lift, the verb. It's just a posher word.
Okay. Oh,
to raise
that's just Americans getting above themselves. Right?
Ooh, from Great Britain. They are so erudite in Great Britain.
Well, I'm glad you recognise that fact, Linda. Thank you so much for that vote of confidence. Okay.
Yes.
Going back to your novel.
Yeah.
It's set in the past in a real place.
Yes.
How do you feel, how important do you feel it is to get those things right? And how do you go about it?
Well, really important. And I actually spent about 3 days in an old historical archive near Brighton, which holds all of the records for what was the East Cussex... The East Sussex County Mental Asylum, and was then subsequently Hellinglie Mental Hospital. Obviously, a lot of those records are not available for anybody to look at because there's, you know, they mention real people. But I've read all of the annual reports from that period, and I looked through lots and lots of newspapers to get an idea of what was happening. I mean, the Second World War is very well documented. But specific things that happened in that part of the country are very well documented in the local newspapers of the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like when the pigs at Hellinglie were sold after the war, things like that. And I have to say, one of my great procrastinations is reading old British psychological journal magazines to find out about insulin coma therapy of pregnant women in 1936. I mean, I can tell you lots about that. So, yeah, I've spent a lot of time in libraries and historical archives and reading other books, you know, reference books and some fiction books that will inform me about the time. So, you know, words like parlour and scullery, those were commonly used words in that period.
Did you envisage how much research there would be before you started?
No, I didn't. I just thought, oh, you just write it, and then you, I think I said a few weeks ago, you then suddenly think, oh, she's going to clean the outside loo for her mum to come and visit. I wonder what the outside loo looked like. Well, at first of all, I thought she was going to clean the loo, and I thought, no, damn it, she won't have a bathroom.
No.
It'll be outside, and she'll probably share it with other families, because somewhere along the way I'd pick that up.
Mm.
And that's the sort of thing, if you get it wrong, it can really, it's a bit like a continuity error in a film, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, right.
You kind of said that she went upstairs to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Somebody would immediately pick you up that in a house that was built in Victorian times in 1940, there was no, you know, or 1920 or whatever, you know, there was no inside bathroom. Houses were just built with outside loos that were shared by
We're quite hot, aren't we, on, you know, watching films and television programmes, you know, when they slip in these little anachronisms and people, you know, immediately fire off
to points of view and letters
complaining. Yeah. But it does happen in novels as
it
well.
It does. I spotted one in an otherwise very good novel. I'm not going to name it or the author. And it's just a little thing, but it's a novel with a 17th century setting, and right at the beginning, one of the characters is searching for her crochet gloves. Now, I happen to know crochet was not invented till the 19th century, whereas knitting, obviously, has been around for millennia. But it kind of, you know, it jarred with me immediately.
Because you knew that crochet was a fairly modern thing.
And you see, just there's always a reader out there like Teresa. But the thing is, I find that if I come across something like that that I know about, I don't trust the writer as much as if there's another one, I really am not going to trust her to be, or him, for, you know, to do the work properly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it goes to show how many books are so well written. You know, we talk about the fictive dream, don't we? You know, I've learned that from you guys. And, you know, when you're in the flow of reading a book, the last thing you want is something to jolt you out of it and send you scurrying off to Google to check your facts.
Maybe you have to talk about what the fictive dream is. Stephanie, do you know?
Well, for me, it's just that kind of complete absorption in the story, you know, so you don't hear what's going on and... but if something happens in the story that doesn't feel real, it will make you sort of realise that you're actually reading a story and you're not really there, you know. Yeah. Or if there's what you might call the intrusion of the author, if the author suddenly addresses you directly when you've been, you know, talking in third person or something, then that can jolt you out of it and suddenly remind you that you're reading a story.
Yeah, so the world you create, and it doesn't even have to be... a real world, the world you create has to be consistent and hang together.
And authentic.
Have a sense of it. So Nicola, for instance, with sci-fi, presumably
That's an interesting one because I'm. You'd think you have a lot more freedom because you can just make anything up. But I've just been going through the process of inventing names for my 11 alien races, and so
you
I
did
started,
that on our retreat, though.
I did. first of all, you know, I was struggling with our short rights, well, the free rights about giving people names, and then we were discussing names in novels and how much more depth it gave them if their names related in some way to their personalities or their role within the novel. So I started going to look for names that meant something. So I was looking at my hero and my heroine and my, you know, all the different archetypes that will be appearing in the novel. And I went looking for names that meant something that were related to the archetype they were playing. And I found some amazing websites where you can get the meaningofnames.com is one. And then so when I was starting to think about the different alien races, and I was thinking each alien race, I wanted them to embody a particular characteristic of the rules of living a good life. Mm-hmm. So I wrote out the rules, you know, the precepts, the 12 tenets, the precepts, whatever it is. And then I boiled it down to sort of a short phrase. And then I went looking for names that would embody that phrase. And it was really interesting because those websites pulled together names from all around the globe. Mm-hmm. And as I was looking down the names, some names jumped out at me as being particularly suitable for being an alien race name. And I don't know where I've got that from because I don't know any alien races. But some of them just jumped out as being more alien-like than others. Right. And and in fact, the book we talked about the other week, June, that is a brilliant example because they marry things like French words with Arabian names and words, and that worked particularly
in
well
a portmanteau.
So now I've got to come up with the alien races worlds and things like that. So I'm doing quite a lot of work before I have written two short chapters, but I'm doing quite a lot of work before because I think the story will flow better if I don't have to stop and then go and find these things out or decide
on
those
I tend to come across things that I need
And what you were saying, you know, about authenticity, but because you're and not being free, because you're creating imaginary worlds, it's actually you have to create the rules under which those worlds operate, and you have to be consistent within that. And at the same time as you're telling a story, you're teaching the reader the rules of this particular world. So it's not, if you like, the free fantasy that people sometimes.
I ordered a really good book last weekend called "The 12 Rules for Creating Imaginary Worlds," and it was cross genre. So it was talking about, you know, if you're writing a detective novel, you have certain rules you have to follow. Mm. And one of the interesting rules I came across was that there is never ever any magic in a science fiction world,
right?
You know, so it's really unusual to find things that are, you've got hard sci-fi, they call it, and it's where it's, you know, artificial intelligence and robots and things like that. Right. But you wouldn't see any magic creeping into a hard...
That's Harry Potter and fantasy books.
Well, that's fantasy, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, Teresa, you read us recently that was set in a Greek village.
Yeah.
Is that entirely made up, or is that
real? The village itself combines features of several Greek villages that I know well and have spent time in. I'm not Greek, and therefore when it comes, you know, I am writing from my experience of Greek village life and the time that I've spent in a Greek village, but you still have to do research when you start writing about things like in another passage of the book, a mother and daughter are speculating on why the priest isn't married. So I'm not of the Orthodox religion. I wasn't raised in that religion, so I need to find out things like, why are some priests married and some not, and what difference does it make? For example, the village priests can, and more often than not, are married and have families and live within the community. But the bishops and archbishops are celibate. So if you have political ambitions within the church, you wouldn't marry. So things like that. And I do look things up, and I do research and talk to people as well. If there's something I don't know about religious practice, then I can...
How do you talk to a Greek person about...
Well, many Greek people speak English.
English people speak Greek.
Many people are bilingual, and you know, I'm learning Greek as well as I go along. So yeah, I know some Greek, and I can communicate. So I was asking Steph the question about research, because you sort of think, I'll just start off writing, and then you think, oh, hang on, is that true, or is that, you know, it's just something I've heard and
misconception? That's the last thing you want.
Especially as I am the most pedantic reader, I would be the one.
You're setting very high standards for yourself.
Linda.
Yeah.
Did you?
Well, you know, the work I'm doing right now with Mary Magdalene and her father taking this trip, it's set in the mid-50s, and I wanted to have the journey go, you know, from place to place and have them to be real places. But then I realized, I went online looking, and the interstate system was not, I think, it wasn't started until, I think, 1956. And, of course, there wasn't enough of it at that point that they would have, it's not going to go all over the country in a year or two. So I went online to look if I could find some maps that were before the interstate and you know, in that time period, and actually found some on eBay. So I have these very old maps, and now because they're fragile, I've had to make, you know, copies of, and so I'm mapping out their route from, I know I wanted to be in West Virginia, and they're going, of course, to Little Rock, which she thinks is glamorous. And so I'm mapping their way on these old roads, and it's very complicated the way they have to go. It's not like getting on I-95 and go. And so I find that's a little difficult because there's so many little ways they go. But it will be good, too, because it gives me opportunities to set up obstacles for them as well.
And it also possibly literally sends them in different directions. Do you think it might send you in different directions in terms of the development of the story?
I think it will, because I think you know how things, as you're writing, you go along and then something occurs, and you, oh, this could happen here, or that you're inspired to do that. But the thing I noticed, too, when I was rereading a bit that I'd written before, I had them pulling off onto an access road. That's not going to happen. That's only after the interstate.
The interstate's like a motorway, then, is it?
Yeah.
Well, of course, Stephanie.
That's another one of those.
Highway,
Okay.
A motorway?
Motorway is just like a big road, really.
Yeah. Well, a highway is like that too, but it's probably much larger than those you have in Great Britain.
It's bound to be.
Must be.
The distances are so much further to go on.
Yeah. They really are, yeah.
But then you're talking about access road. That's one of the things, and I think this is perhaps difficult to research, because one of the things that bugs me sometimes with period pieces is the inappropriate language that you sometimes get if people put in an expression that you know or you feel must be much later.
Yeah,
I've got a good example of that in Hellinglie, which starts in 1941, and then we get some flashbacks to the 1920s. I hope you will never find the word okay. Because apparently okay only came into common British parlance after the Second World War, because it was an Americanism that was brought over by the GIs.
Did you find that out by accident? Or
I can't remember, to be honest. I think I might have had a kind of strange feeling and gone back and looked at the etymology of...
And you know that many people believe that it's Greek.
Greek, yeah.
It's a Greek expression.
For olokala.
But it went to England by way of Americans. And what a handy-dandy little word.
Somebody sit on that woman.
Well, you said a good one earlier when we were talking about this. What was the one you found in Vikings?
Oh, yes, the TV series Vikings. It slightly gets on my nerves when they say things like, oh, you said you would have my back.
Which now, that's an Americanism, isn't
it? It's a very modern expression.
Yeah.
But it's why does that stand out when, in fact, they're all speaking modern English?
Yes.
Although there's a bit of Norman French in some places where they speak old French.
That is the trouble. You have to make the language understandable. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had medieval settings and everybody spoke medieval English, we wouldn't understand the word.
And who's ever tried to read A Clockwork Orange?
I have.
Oh, yeah, I loved it and managed it, but your brain...
I tried and failed.
You have to suspend your
Well, you have to learn a new language.
You do, essentially, as you're going. Yeah.
Which is different.
It's hard work.
Creating a realistic world, if you like, set in a particular period, and then using the wrong language. Yeah. It would be like, you know, Teresa's crochet gloves putting in an appearance.
Well, I'm sure lots of people are going to go on our Facebook group now and say, okay,
give us examples.
Okay, it's been here since 1726, as I heard it here, but I did research it and I decided that's
the problem. You have to pick your research.
You have to choose, and I decided sounded a bit too modern.
But one of the things I most loved about Ian Banks' The Culture novels was that it's set very far in the future, you know, thousands of years in the future. And he had the artificial intelligences using slang words from the where we are now, you know, the 20th, 21st century. And for some reason, I found that really funny.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was just such a brilliant use of colloquialisms by creatures that you wouldn't think would know or use that kind of language. So he did it really well.
Okay, well, thank you for that, ladies.
Oh, then you did a little word. You said okay. Then you have.
How many times it's been used in broadcasts?
You know, I think we need to know. We need to know K-ometer. That goes wheeh.
Perhaps we should have an okay box, and you put a pound in
every time you say okay.
Oh, and then
all right. I think that's an excellent idea.
We'll spend the proceeds on
that. And Linda could put a quid in.
We'll spend it on lashings of ginger beer.
Oh, for heaven's sake, lashings?
We'll explain it later, Linda. Okay. Don't you worry about it. Okay, so sorry. I'm going to have to ban it.
Order in the past.
Okay, moving swiftly on, as it's nearly time to wrap up, let's hear what Nicola's reading at the moment.
The gentleman I only just mentioned, in fact, Ian Banks, my son. I've got an Amazon wish list that I randomly fire stuff onto. And then when my birthday comes around, I say I'll just pick something from the wish list. And I get all sorts of strange things that I'd forgotten I ever wanted. One of them being a book by Ian Banks. It's called Raw Spirit, In Search of the Perfect Dram. And I had no idea what it was going to be about, but I thought, I've read everything else he's done, so I may as well read this. Ian Banks is widely acknowledged as one of the British greatest living writers, except he's not anymore, bless him. His 20 critically acclaimed novels have received rave reviews for their mordant wit, sparkling prose and staggering feats of imagination. As a Scotsman, he knows something about whiskey too. In Raw Spirit, Ian combines these two passions with a third, travel. Result, a unique journey around his native land. His goal, to find the perfect dram. And the perfect dram surely must be a single malt whiskey. And I just picked it up and I was looking at it, and there was a really nice little bit in here where he said, I knew I was going to like the book when he's having a conversation with his agent, who apparently is a real Rottweiler. And she says something along the lines of, how do you fancy being driven around every distillery in Scotland in a taxi and drinking lots of whiskey and then writing a book about it for a not insubstantial sum? What do you think? Huh? Interested? I was so excited, I think I took my foot off the desk. I thought quickly, no, really, can I drive the taxi as well? Then you can't drink. I'll do the drinking later, then I don't see why not. Why a taxi anyway? I think they're going for the incongruity factor. A black cab around the Highlands, etc., etc. These people are from London, aren't they? Where else? Plus, I think they thought that you could share some witty repartee with a garrulous Glasgow cabbie. So they don't know me. Good, good. Anyway, Banksy, what do you think? Can we ditch the taxi? And basically, the whole scene is him just going through, deconstructing their whole idea and coming out at the end of it with the gig. And he says, brilliant, I'll do it.
Excellent.
Thank you for that one. What's it called again?
It's called Raw Spirit in Search of the Perfect Dram.
All right.
I can do it in a Scottish accent if you prefer.
try, go on.
In Search of the Perfect Dram.
Oh, now, all our Scottish listeners will be howling outrage. In pain and outrage.
All our Scottish
and is that Ian or Ian M?
Well, he wrote his modern novels under the name Ian Banks, but it's got an I in it, so yeah. I. And then he did all his sci-fi under Ian M. Banks.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, Ian, he's one of those people that I keep meaning to read and I still haven't got around.
Well, I would highly recommend
it. I like the sound of that.
I've read some Ian Banks, they're good.
Steph, I believe you're going to talk to us also about what's on your bedside table.
What's on my bedside table this week is actually a very old book that I first read when I was in my late teens, I think. Mm. And I remember when I read it, I found it nearly impossible to speak to a man civilly about a week afterwards. because it just made me so angry. I don't know how many of you have read it, but it's called The Women's Room, and it's by Marilyn French. Yeah. It's still in print 40 years later. It was first published in, 41 years later now. It was first published in 1977. Mm-hmm. I have the 30th anniversary edition, which is one of those books that goes with me everywhere, so I revisit it occasionally. So I've read it before, but it never... it never fails to
arouse
my passions, arouse me. It was the debut novel. Funny, I seem to always be going for debut novelists, but it was this one is American. Sorry, Nicola. Oh. American debut novelist, Marilyn French, published in 1977. And it really was quite instrumental at the start of the kind of feminist movement. Mm. Although Marilyn French herself said it wasn't about the women's movement, it was about women's lives. Mm-hmm. But it was very influential. It's set in 1950s America and follows the fortunes of a young woman in a traditional marriage and what happens as her awakening comes and her... you wouldn't really call it coming of age, but there is a sense of that kind of between the 40s and the 60s, what happened. She had children through the baby booms and her friends were all expected to be housewives and prioritise their roles as wives and mothers and so on. There's a couple of quotes from it which really always stick in my head. One was this, it's a short paragraph which I'll read to you. Later she would remember these years and realise with astonishment that she had, by 15, decided on most of the assumptions she would carry for the rest of her life. That people were essentially not evil, that perfection was death, that life was better than order and a little chaos good for the soul. Most important, this life was all. Unfortunately, she forgot these things and had to remember them the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
I think men should read it as well, but I guess it's called The Women's Room. It kind of puts them off. Yeah. There's another one. I must have known for a long time that hypocrisy is the secret of sanity. You mustn't let them know you know. Yeah, it's a wonderful book. Please read it.
It is. The line I remember most from that book was about you have to clean up your own vomit. Remember she went to the ladies' room when she was sick and someone, I don't know, someone said something true about it. She said, well, everyone should clean up their own vomit, which meant a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. I remember reading it. It was certainly, I haven't reread it for a long, long time. I think I might just do that.
Yeah, I think you should. I think you should go back to it. It's one of those books that doesn't really ever lose its power, really. I just have to be really careful. I'm not going to be around too many men for a little while afterwards.
Good time for me to read it then. I think we should start compiling in our Facebook group the top 10 science fiction books, the top 10 women's, top 10 great American literature, novels. Novels, or, they might grow to 20 or 30 eventually, but I think if someone was coming in and not knowing where to start on reading, I think that would be a really good crib sheet.
The top 10 according to us.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Totally subjective. Yeah.
Or perhaps our listeners would like to nominate.
Well, exactly, well, I'm saying if we start off with a 10 each, then they can welcome additions to that list.
Right. Yeah. I'd like to hear what their opinions are if they've read some of the books we've mentioned as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Perhaps you could start a thread on that one.
I will.
Okay. So, unfortunately, we're out of time. So that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. As always, we hope you've enjoyed the show. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a review. And don't forget to enter our Flash Fiction competition. Details are on our Facebook page. Just search for Write Club, the podcast. So until next week, happy writing and goodbye.
Bye. Bye.